you all for joining us for our most recent Tech and EdTech. Today, we are super excited to have Rick Ferry from Savvis Learning join us. So we will be talking about integrating universal design for learning with digital accessibility initiatives. I'm Erin Evans. I work here at Magic as one of our strategic solution members in the consulting unit. And Rick, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So as we get started, give me a little bit of background about how you got into your role at Savvis Learning and your journey since.
Well, I think for me, getting into accessibility was an accident. You know, I wish I could tell you it was a plan, my goal all along, but actually I've been in educational publishing for almost my entire adult working life. And at one point I was working for a small content development company based out of Boston, and I ran into some folks from CAST, David Rose, Skip Stahl, Chuck Hitchcock. They came to our office and they showed us some amazing things they were doing on brain research. And their whole premise was that print wasn't just inaccessible to a lot of folks, that it actually wasn't the best medium for a lot of learners to get access to content, engage with content. And I was so impressed with the fact that it was rooted in science. And from that day forward, I kept thinking, if this works for kids that have these types of challenges, that the mainstream implications would be amazing, right? That it could improve education. So that sort of changed my trajectory into, even though I wish to get to how I planned it, I didn't really plan it, into an accessibility and advocating for students with challenges almost the rest of my career. And so I've been in the business a while. I have a lot of different roles, but no matter whether it was in my title or not, I've always been involved in accessibility. And then a few years ago, Pearson sold off their K-12 unit, which became the Savvis Learning Company. And I had been doing some consulting and I just missed the education market. And so they said, hey, we have an open, would you like to come back? And so I've been back 2.5 years, a little bit longer. And it's just been great. You know, I miss K-12. I was in higher ed. I was actually in business and healthcare, doing consulting work, and it's just been exciting to be back in K-12, which is my first love and the place where I feel most comfortable. So since I've been back, you know, they've made a real commitment to accessibility, and it's sort of been a match made in heaven. Again, no great plans of mine. It's just lucky if you hang around long enough, Erin, and you know some things, you end up being valuable folks. So I couldn't be happier with the role of the company and the things we're doing to help kids with disabilities.
I love how you said you kind of fell into accessibility, because I have found a lot of people who are in accessibility roles have that same, I just sort of found it mentality, right? And I think that's great, because we are all coming from different backgrounds, joining together to move forward and understanding how important it is to take accessibility as far as we can go.
And one of the interesting things to me is that someone like myself, who came in accidentally, the other population, or at least a large percentage of the population, have people that have been affected either themselves directly or loved ones. And so I think that's an interesting sort of path into accessibility as well, or any sort of area where you're working with students with have any kind of challenges, right? And so it's one of the gratifying things about it is being able to help those people who are coming at it from the fact that it's affecting their lives immediately and directly, either personally or loved ones. So I think that's sort of the two camps that probably make up the most of this are folks like myself that kind of wander into it, and others who have a real purpose to find out what's going on because they want to. So it's an interesting mix of people from that perspective.
I absolutely agree. As we move forward into today's agenda, you did mention CAST, which I was hoping you could define for our listeners who aren't as familiar with CAST as everybody else may be. And then also, if you could just, you know, tell us a little bit about what Universal Design for Learning is.
Well, CAST, I don't know their exact history, because I met them. I think CAST had already been at it a few years. And it's this center, I'm embarrassed to remember, I say I can't remember the Center for Applied Science Technology, I'm not quite sure, but they've been around for a long time, and they were started by David Rose and some other folks who came out of Harvard who were different disciplines, right? And I think what attracted me to them right away was just the way they looked at education was completely different, right? From the standard, you know, you go to school, you learn to become a teacher or an administrator. And they were really interested in sort of I don't know if they articulate this way, but breaking down all these barriers and breaking down the things. And so I think early on, one of the things CAST had done was actually help Scholastic and different companies develop tools based on what they knew, right? And then the universal design for learning is an outgrowth of universal design, right? Which came out about the idea that physical access for folks, right? The idea of architecture and changing buildings so that people with any kind of physical disabilities or other impairments could get access, physical access into places they needed to be. And so UDL comes from that idea that taking that same concept of engineering, right, of thinking of designing things for access to the education environment. And it isn't just materials or buildings, right? It's the whole approach to education. It's really a framework is what UDL is. So I think from that standpoint, again, I was very attracted to that because I think education can be very sedentary, right? And it gets very traditional and it's a hard institution to change. And I think what's been interesting about CAST and particularly with UDL is this idea of being able to approach change at different levels, right? And different levels whether you're building organization or your teacher strategies or your student engagement, it just gives you a way to think about educating that's different than the traditional path through that. Yep. So what specifically about UDL, I think one of the things is it's a framework, right? I think it's not a technical standard like WCAG, and we can talk more about that later. And I think what makes it difficult for folks is that initially this idea of engaging students and giving them different ways to represent themselves and show what they know and engage with the curriculum is really simple, right? That people get that and it resonates easily. It's then when you get into the details of how do I put this and what does this look like in a classroom day, right? What do I do as a teacher? What does this mean for the student or administrators? It can get really complicated. And I think it gets, for some folks, too esoteric because they want to be told do step one, step two, step three. And I think that's not really step one. It's to do your list out tasks, right? Sort of think about how you want to approach UDL. And so I think from that standpoint, it's an easy understanding about the three representation, engagement, and action expression. That's an easy piece. That's when you get into it that folks are finding UDL a little challenging. And how does this affect my day job? You know, what do I do as a teacher? What do I do as an administrator? What does that mean for me as a student? Is where UDL can get a little bit complicated for folks.
Yeah, and that's a good segue into, you know, talking to us about how companies, the publishing companies in particular, education tech companies, how are they currently implementing UDL in their products?
Well, I think one of the interesting things, and again, this is just my perspective, you find 50 people, you'd have 49 different ones, right? I think part of this is that there's a lot of UDL in the guidelines and the framework and the approach that a lot of providers are already doing, right? Yes. They may not be as purposeful about it, or they may not be as rigorous in terms of documenting and showing it. But I think, you know, things like, what do I do in small group instruction, right? Here are some other options for students to look at, right? Because one of the great things about UDL is this idea of not making options as an accident or secondary, but making options as a primary piece, right? So I think the other problem with UDL is sometimes it gets too focused on the technology aspects of it. And the technology is absolutely important to supporting UDL, but it isn't UDL, right? Having technology do things doesn't mean you're doing UDL. So I think it starts with the program design. So I think for people providing educational materials to the market, the first thing is, what are you doing already that supports the UDL framework, right? And then I think for providers, what's happening is that after the pandemic and everyone was online all the time, there are a bunch of cracks exposed in digital learning, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and it wasn't so much, sorry?
I said, yes, definitely.
Yeah. Well, I think no one planned to be online all the time for every aspect of school with no options, right? And so what happened was that exposed a lot of crack, not so much in the actual, you know, curriculum itself, you know, here's my history curriculum, here's this. That part sort of worked. It's all the other things around it, right? So let's say if you had kids that needed speech therapy or were on IPs, and a lot of the IPs are based on observation, right? That just really couldn't happen. And so I think a lot of things were exposed around, yeah, you can log in and yeah, you can get your assignment, but all the other stuff that goes with learning, right? And that you get in a school environment, there were big problems with that, and it was gaps. And I think what's happening now is because of that experience, folks are realizing that they need maximum flexibility, right? To me, at least in my view, the genie's out of the bottle. You know, may not always be online all the time, but a blended environment, you know, digital and brick and mortar, is here to stay, right? And I think it's going to vary between state, between district, between buildings even, right? I think you'll have some folks show up for classes physically and other kids do it online depending on what the class is, right? So I think that amount of variability between how you're going to do things online and the technology that you need to learn with has really changed the game. So it isn't just a question of, here's a bunch of questions, answer them. It's like, where do I get homework? How do I get feedback from the teacher, right? What are the other resources I can use? And so I think the opportunity and the challenge for providers like Savvis is it isn't just about making the product. Just here's your curriculum for math, right? It's about all the other things the teacher needs and the student needs and all the other resources that you could have available in a school. You now need some way to figure out how to use those in an online environment, because chances are good some point during the day you're going to have interaction that is digitally focused versus being in a classroom with a traditional teacher and you're sitting there listening piece.
And I agree. And I think what you were saying about how the pandemic uncovered some of those gaps and how everybody was shifted to an online learning system, definite pros, but then it definitely also showed how varied learners are, something we already know in the educational system, but it just really exposed that. And I think that that is a big driver for how UDL is coming into play into those curriculums and into those classrooms.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting, and you'll have to tell me to stop because I'll get on my soapbox and I'll never get off. I mean, one of the interesting things to me is that, and this is something that's near and dear to me, this whole discussion about what assistive technology is, right? So in the context for many years, assistive technology was primarily directed at kids that had some sort of challenge, right? Either physical impairments or cognitive impairments, right? It wasn't mainstream. And I think from that standpoint, if you think about a kid now, they have in their hands these smartphones that have more processing power than, you know what I mean? It's just amazing the technology available to them. And so this idea of what does assistive mean and to whom and why, right? So if you have an IEP or 504 and you have a very specific thing, you know, you get assigned technology that you need. But what we're seeing in the marketplace is you've got districts assigning tools to do word-by-word audio highlighting or translation, or here, you know, instead of writing your answer, you can speak it or you can record a video. We're starting to see more and more districts make that available to everyone. So this idea that this assistive technology is meant for a certain group of kids and generally around specific disabilities, I think has to be challenged, right? Obviously, there are some kids that need very specific types of technology to help them access and make progress in the curriculum, right? But I think we have to sort of open the box up a little bit and think that technology as a tool, as a support, as a communication is important to all students, because once they leave school, they're going to be spending a lot of time on technology just as their normal lives, right? I mean, banking, getting your health records, all that sort of stuff. And so I think one of the challenges in the K-12 environment is we got to think a little bit different about, you know, technology generally, you know, what's assistive and, you know, what technology can we make available to all folks versus that stuff that some kids absolutely need and making sure they're still getting that. And then how does that affect things like assessment and how does that affect things like progress monitoring? So I'm very excited about it. I know it's challenging because there's a lot of questions that don't have answers but I just think it's great because I do think, you know, you've seen these tools now where if English is not your first language, you can write on the fly, have a conversation now that you would never be able to before. And I think that's really important for kids that English is not their first language, right, in school. And so I think schools are struggling with that because the possibilities are overwhelming. And they can easily outstrip the ability to manage it and focus it and making sure that, you know, people are being measured, that there's equity, that there's a whole bunch of other things that have to come into play there. But I do think the other piece of this is we need to rethink what assistive technology is and then what that means for all the students, not just kids that traditionally have been the ones identified as needing device X or Y or software X or Y.
So that's a really good point. And that brings up my next question for you, which is how are UDL and the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines alike and how are they different?
Well, I think it's interesting because one of the things that's happening in the K-12 market is that we get from the states and districts and even from schools questions about the accessibility of the product. Some of these questions are called UDL questions, right? Or questionnaire or ADA questions. And they're not really any of those things, right? So I think there's some confusion in the market, and it's understandable, right? Because UDL and accessibility are different. So WCAG is a technical, you know, a mature, evolved, managed standard, right? Properly managed standard. And, you know, you've got the W3C managing, you've got releases, you've got the whole thing that you need to do, which is a very rigorous approach to manage a technical standard. It's an international technical standard. There are rules about how it works. So from that standpoint, that's the first fundamental difference between that and UDL. UDL is a dynamic framework, right? It isn't managed the same way that WCAG is managed, right? And one of the things that I think in our market that people have to be careful with is that you can say, oh, we have UDL supports built into our product. That doesn't mean it's accessible, right? And the same thing, you can say, I have an accessible product, but that doesn't mean it's following UDL guidelines, right? And as you well know, Erin, there's overlap between, there are some ways to align the WCAG success criteria with the UDL checkpoints, but it's not nebulous isn't the right word. It isn't necessarily a deep connection. And I think what I always encourage to our customers and folks when I give presentations and speeches about, it's like, look, decide if you need something accessible, then you say to what level, right? You can say, I need this, I need to be 2.1, I need it 2.0, I need it to be whatever level that you want it to be accessible. Then there's a kind of a very specific, concrete way to say, yes, we're there or not. There's some issues with that, which I'll get to in a second. UDL is a little bit different, right? UDL isn't, well, be to this level of compliance. I think what I would encourage you to say is, hey, do you have ways for kids to provide multiple means of expressing themselves? So if the question says, fill in the blank, do they have to type it? Can they record their voice? Can they make a video? Could they print out a piece of paper and draw a picture versus using words, right? So I think what makes UDL more challenging is that it isn't just point, give me X, Y, and Z and UDL's done, right? It's got to fit sort of what it is your expectations are for your students in terms of being able to engage with the material. One of the other interesting things that we're seeing in the market with UDL is folks focus on that technology piece, right? So a lot of questions about, do you do word by word audio highlighting? Do you do speech to text? Do you, and these are all good things for students, right? It provides flexibility. But having any of them doesn't mean you're doing UDL. Do you know what I mean? It's an important piece of it. So I think as we go forward, what I'm hoping is there's more clarity in the market about stuff should be accessible. You should ask for accessibility. You should say at the level, and there's ways to measure it, right? For UDL, I think it's a bigger discussion than just is it accessible or not. You know, what's your student population? What is it that you're looking for? What are your teachers comfortable with? Is there a lot of small group instruction, or are there physical spaces in your school where your students can go out? Or do you have some students who would rather be online for whatever reason, they're not comfortable in a school? Then how does your product and your services support those, right? So I think the UDL piece is broader and more complicated, and isn't necessarily going to fit in a nice little yes, no, click the box kind of form. But right now, folks seem to be trying to fit that in there. And I think, you know, early days that it's proving not to be as effective. And I expect that sort of clarity to get better as we go forward.
Yeah. And I think that also applies to the WCAG guidelines. There are some places where it is very cut and dry. And then there are some places where it's a little nebulous. And, you know, you were talking about the text to speech or the word by word highlighting. And those are all fantastic tools to assist in learning, but that doesn't mean that they are also accessible tools. So there's a lot of moving parts and pieces to assess what is it, as you were saying, what is it exactly that your need is? What are you looking for? And how are you asking for that? And how are you ensuring that the product you're looking for, you're building, has all of that involved?
Yeah. And I think the other piece of that with accessibility, and there's, you know, you can ask for VPATs, right? You can ask for certification. And I think those are good tools, right? I think VPATs can tell you the level of compliance. I think the bigger problem that we're running into now is something can be accessible technically and checklist compliance and still provide a bad user experience, right? That it's accessible, but it's also bad. So that's why I think the UDL and the accessibility piece come together. And in sort of my vision of the future, which probably is crazy, but the idea of all products should be accessible, right? That shouldn't really be a big discussion at some point any longer, right? And then once you've got that accessibility, to me, that's the baseline, right? If there's a barrier to the student accessing the curriculum, it's kind of game over, right? It could be a good product, could be a bad product. They don't have a chance to know that because they can't access to it. Once you eliminate that accessibility barrier, and once they're using the product, then their experience, their user outcome isn't based on accessibility anymore, right? It's based on a lot of other things, based on program design and where what can students do to engage? Do they see themselves in the curriculum? Is there ways to get access to it? So I hope at some point in the future, and I think slowly but surely the districts and states are moving there, it's like, got to be accessible, you know, step one, right? We don't have to have a conversation about it anymore. It's accessible. Now, what is it about your product that meets the needs of my students, right? And you said to me, what's the biggest thing is you got to be crystal clear about what are your goals. If you're in a district that has a sizable ELL population or something, then there are some specific things you're looking for to support that population, right? Or if you've got a group where you've got kids that are, you have more fluidity about, they're not necessarily going from band to band, grade to grade, then how can I get more challenging material to the students? How can I get more specific content to where the students are, right? Those are the things UDL can help with. But I think it all starts with really asking providers like yourselves, what is it that you need in the product, right? And there's a lot of talk most of the time about aligning to standards, right? The state standards, the district standard, and all that's good stuff too. But even then, aligned to the standards doesn't necessarily mean it's, right? It's like accessibility to me. It's got to be aligned to standards, got to be accessible, right? If you're not doing that, then I don't see how you're successful in the market. What makes you successful is then how are you improving student outcomes, right? That's really where the game is. And it's going to take, we're getting really close, but I think at some point, some of this more baseline, and it doesn't mean easy, but baseline stuff will just be in play. And then, you know, it's up to us to make products that address all your students' needs, right? That help your teachers create really flexible environments with options for kids in this blended world we live in. So I'm hoping at some point that's where we get to. It's just going to take some time.
Yeah, I agree. And with that, I'm going to kind of switch us to talking about the future and thinking about, you know, what tech considerations do you think need to be made for the successful execution of UDL?
Well, I think there's a couple things, and I've been thinking about this a lot because it's part of part of trying to understand. One of the first place to start is that you as a school or a district or building or state or whatever level that you want to think about this, you've got to think about your infrastructure first and foremost, right? What is your technology infrastructure plan? What do you have an LMS? Do you have your own login systems? What do you have? And then what's the goal of that? How are you maintaining that? Because I think one of the big challenges around UDL from a technology perspective is interoperability, right? Because, oh, there's this great tool, this great product, I want to get it. And then, well, except that your login approach doesn't allow this to work, or the way these products are built, I can't run the third-party products that you've purchased for the benefit of your students. So the very first thing, I think, is a more holistic look at your environment, right? Here's my technology infrastructure, right? Here's how my students get onto our system. Here's what they do. Here's what the parents do. Here's what the teachers do, right? And they're going to have to get, not slave to standards, but they're going to have to establish some level of standards and say, look, we want your product to be interoperable with this. Here's our third-party support tools. Here's our grading tools. Here's our attendance tools, right? And some states and districts are pretty sophisticated about it and others aren't. So I think the very first thing is trying to understand what do you need your technology infrastructure in the school to do, right? So that's step one. And then maybe not step one or two, but sort of another point is, are you giving your kids Chromebooks? You give them iPads? You're going to let them use your phones? What can they use your phones for, right? So part of that infrastructure has to be, how are you going to let your students and your teachers and your parents, administrators, everyone, work with your infrastructure? Is it going to be locked down so that they can only get in through certain things? Do you provide devices? Are you going to let people own their own devices? Or, you know, so a lot of that, and I'm making this sound like it's a simple thing. It's not, right? You've got to start there, because then the rest of it doesn't work, right? If you say, gosh, I love this speech highlighting tool, or I love this translating or this word prediction or this masking tool or whatever it is you think you want, you can't just go buy that. Well, you shouldn't just go buy that without thinking about, how is this going to work in my environment? Is it compatible with my devices, right? What's going to happen? Am I going to make sure it works on all the devices I give the students, or are we expecting them to use their phones or their own computers when they get home, right? So I think none of this stuff is very sexy. It's kind of boring, right? But I do think it's a more and more critical piece for schools to have to get their heads around if they're going to take advantage of this technology and if they're going to approach from a UDL perspective, right? So there's a technology piece, I think, in the future that the states and districts are going to have to get a little bit more on top of, and they will, right? But I just think it's one of those things that these are not necessarily technical environments, right? You know, this isn't why people get into education, because I want to be an IT person, right? And I think so that part is going to be a little challenging to the breadth of things that they're going to be facing. And then on the design, product design piece, I think part of it has to be, what is the design? You know, whether you have text-to-speech highlighting built in, or you can do speech-to-text or whatever, that's one piece of it. It's sort of like, what's the design of your product? You know, what is it possible for a student teacher to say, oh, I have a group of students who I think would work better in group on this, right? Can I have this curriculum work so that they can work collaboratively, right? I have a student who, for whatever reason, doesn't have the right motor skills to draw, and we need to let them speak their answers. We need to let them, right? So I think part of it is, how is the curriculum set up to engage those students? Are there ways that they can see themselves reflected in this and then get engaged in it and respond in a way that works for them, right? And so that's what I mean about the options. And that's a design. The technology, again, is important, but I just think that's part of this has to be at the product design, asking about the product design, right? How does your product support via the UDL framework the things I need in my district, right? I need those abilities for students to work together, small groups. I need some folks the ability would get up and just do a presentation or record a presentation. And that's sort of a new thing right now, right? Because I think it exists, but I don't think it's been as formal and it's baked in as it needs to be. And then the assessment piece is really critical, right? So it's great that you can give folks options to show and express their knowledge and their mastery of these things, but the teacher's also going to have to be able to assess it. And it's one thing to go through and click the multiple choice boxes. It's another thing to have to go through and watch a 5-minute video that someone put together and then decide, yes, they get it, they don't get it, right? So there's some challenges around the assessment piece that need to be worked out. Right. So I think on one hand, there is a technology piece that the school and the district and the state have to get their arms around. And then there's a whole other piece about the design of the product. Right. You don't have to ask the technical questions. It's like, explain to me how this works with a population where I have, you know, 20% of my kids reading below grade level. Right. What can you do for me then? And so I think that's where I see the future of UDL. Not just I align with the standards, not just I'm accessible, but here's how I can do to match your environment and your learner profiles.
All right. So one more question, and then I have our final wrap-up question. But how do you think that integrating UDL and WCAG will shape or change learning as we look ahead into the next 5, 10, 20 years into the future?
Well, I'm terrible at predicting the future, and I've been wrong so many times. Otherwise, you know, I'd be making a lot of money. I think a couple of things. I think this idea of students as individuals, right, and being able to more easily, if things are planned and done properly, meet the individuals where they need to be, right? Because the whole promise of technology has been for a while in education, right? Oh, it's data-driven, and I can assign students individual pieces, right? Based on the data, if they get these answers wrong, I can give them instruction to help, right? I think that model never really worked the way it could have, because I think it was too linear and too restrictive in a lot of ways, right? I think where UDL can change that is, okay, here's the questions you get wrong. Here's, you know, what you can do to get your mastery of this content. But now here's a bunch of different options for you to show that mastery, right? If you're not a verbal person, if you're more a visual person, you can go ahead and sketch this out and show us what you're doing, right? Or if you are a verbal person and you'd much rather do that than write, here's a way that I can express this piece of it. So I think this idea of data-driven instantaneous feedback to help direct instruction to kids so they can show they understand the concepts and the things they need to learn now has a chance to work better, right? Because I think the idea of it was great at the beginning, but it was such a limited response. It's like, well, here's another 5,000 things to read to hopefully you'll get your score. But if you don't earn a good reader or reading's not your thing, that's not going to help you, right? And I think the other thing as they're updating the UDL guidelines is that the idea of finding what engages students, right? Letting them have more choice. It's not infinite choices, right? There's still rigorous standards. There's still things they have to learn. But there can be options for them to, hey, you know, I want to learn this next. Or in this particular topic, I'd like to go here, right? So I think the promise of UDL actually can make this idea of data-driven learning work. Because it isn't really working. It's too linear. It's too fixed. And it doesn't have the flexibility. If you have more of a UDL approach and this idea of options for students and the ability, look, and I've always felt, and again, this is getting crazy, right? This idea, get kids up at 8 a.m. when they're teenagers. There's been tons of research that shows they're not really firing all cylinders at 8 a.m. Let them do it at 5. Like, let them do it at different times. I think if we can, as long as we can show rigor, right, as long as we can show mastery of concept and students are actually learning what they're supposed to and that can be measured, I think this idea of flexibility is really going to free up education, or it can, right? This idea of this rigid idea, I go to school and I do this at 8 and I do this at 9, you know, I think that can be a little more fluid than it is, right? Because you still need discipline, right? You still need folks getting used to the socializing, the being responsible, to doing things on time. That part of it I'm not suggesting should go away. But I do think the UDL layer on top of this is going to make the education a little bit more liberating potentially for the students and hopefully the teachers too, right? And a lot of that has to do with being able to use the technology successfully, but a lot of it has to do with sort of maybe be willing to think a little bit different about how your classroom works and what the student can or can't do. So that to me is a big hope for the future, is that the UDL sort of opens up the box a little bit and lets them err in where it's desperately needed. So it's not one size fits all students. You know, there's one way to learn and it's this way, right? I think that could be really, really helpful. And that's to me the promise of UDL in the future.
Finally, Rick, what advice do you have for people who work in accessibility, learning design, and ed tech?
Well, first of all, it's a great field to get into, right? It's very interesting to me because, you know, I've been in education mostly, but I've left a couple times. And real business is so boring. Do you know what I mean? I think the idea of education, of trying to help people learn, right, to teach them to become better learners, to see them be successful, it's a very exciting thing to do. Look, you know, if you want to make a lot of money, you can go into, you know, options or the financial markets and do whatever you want. But I find really fulfilling this idea that you're helping people become better learners, which potentially can improve their sort of outcomes in life. And I think what's interesting for folks on the accessibility and the UDL side is that, and I believe this very firmly, and this is another thing that CAST has pushed with UDL, right? There is no mythical average learner that's happened in education in the last years. And I love the fact that UDL is aimed at the margins, right? And if you're interested in that, if you're interested in making things work for people who have potential barriers of any kind, socioeconomic, intellectual, if you can get that to work, there's always broader mainstream applications for that. And I would say start with the hard stuff. If you're one of those people that like challenges, then the accessibility, the UDL side is a good way to get into it. Because I think then you have the potential of having a much broader impact across a wider range of students, right? Yeah. rather than, well, here's this one way to do this and it works for one kid. I mean, I think about my own education. I was lucky. I had a good memory, right? So back in the day, having a good memory was a huge part of being successful, right? Because all you had to do was regurgitate what you remembered and you were in good shape, right? And I think if I had to go back to school now, I'd be in trouble because after a while, it isn't just memory, right? It's other things that you have to do. So I would encourage folks who are interested in accessibility and interested in helping folks that are on the margins is the way to go because you're actually helping everybody in that regard, right? Those things, aside from helping those kids that have barriers that in their lives were unfairly placed on them anyway, you have the satisfaction of that. You can also know that you're helping a much broader range of folks because those, and I've seen this over and over, the implications for the mainstream and for average students, whatever that ends up means, is always beneficial. So that's why I would encourage folks to do it. And it's very satisfying. You meet a lot of interesting people and you're always learning, right? You're always learning new stuff.
It's always learning,
right? You can always, you know, on things like demographics and brain research, which I only understand a tiny bit when I read, but it does help me a little bit. So I think that's the other piece of this that's very exciting is that it's not just education. There are other fields and disciplines that you sort of start to pay attention to because it impacts what you do. So that's why I would encourage folks to do it. And I'm happy to help anybody who's interested, point them in directions that they might want to consider in terms of careers.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Rick. And thank you for those of you who have listened to this podcast. We've really enjoyed having you. We hope you've learned some interesting and fun things on UDL. And Rick, again, thank you for your time. And we hope to see you all again on our next episode.
Thank you, Erin.